Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Ryan McGavin, and I'm chairing this session. This session will last for 1 hour. Our first presentation is scheduled to run about 45 minutes, after which we'll turn the time over to our respondent, who will be taking up to 15 minutes. And if time is left for questions, I'll take the podium again and field those questions. By way of introduction of our first speaker, we're happy to have Rick Grunder with us. He's joined us from Syracuse, New York. Rick has his own shop as a proprietor. He calls himself Rick Grunder Books. The paper which he'll be presenting was prepared especially for our consumption and has been prepared over the last 8 months. He was formerly with the Bibliographic Department of Brigham Young University, and we're happy to have him with us this morning. Now, as soon as Rick is completed, I won't take the podium again. We'll just turn the time directly over to our second guest, Paul Edwards, who just flew into town yesterday and will be leaving us Sunday. We wish both of you the happiest of trails in your travels and hope all your arrangements and connections are successful. Paul presently serves as the president of the Temple School in Independence, Missouri. Formerly, he was the academic vice president of Grace College for some 15 years. He and his wife have two grown children, and we're certainly happy to have Paul with us as well. So we'll turn the time immediately over to Rick.
Many unrecognized parallels to Mormonism await our attention in the published and manuscript writings of Joseph Smith's own day. Without an understanding of these crucial sources, Mormon historiography suffers, both in theory and in scope. This might seem strange, since Mormonism enjoys a long tradition of awareness of its own parallels. Joseph Smith quoted indirectly from Ethan Smith in the Times and Seasons and hastened to identify Central American archaeological discoveries with the Nephite cities of the Book of Mormon. A number of modern writers emphasize parallels to Mormon doctrine, which they insist appear in recently unearthed documents from ancient times. Unfortunately, however, many of these authors follow a double standard when it comes to the Mormon parallels in Joseph Smith's own contemporary environment. Many Mormon defenders accept the ancient parallels with an eagerness that belies the narrow resistance they lavish on view of the Hebrews and the few other latter-day examples they seem to recognize. Overly anxious apologists too often respond to the 19th century Mormon parallels by looking for the many details by which these writings differ from the teachings of Joseph Smith. They miss the forest for the trees. They would have our unlearned farm boy as a hopeless, if worthy, lout who could not have managed even the word of wisdom without angelic supervision or heavenly dictation of the most specific kind. But is this fair? Whitney Cross, in the Burned Over District, assures us that in that culture, a person's real education beyond the three R's lay primarily in, quote, accumulating experience. The ideas and attitudes of that generation, probably even more than our own, took form not so much in the schools as in the various informal agencies of newspapers, periodicals, groups, and societies organized to influence opinion, end quote. Cross singles out the clergy as particularly influential in this process and concludes, quote, that York or Yankees were extraordinarily wide awake, well-informed, and ambitious for greater knowledge. Beyond the routine of formal education, they were more alert than most other Americans, end quote, pages 98 and 103. Indeed, Erasmus Turner, who personally remembered teasing Joseph Smith as a lad in Palmyra, recorded that he saw the future prophet, quote, once a week, stroll into the office of the old Palmyra Register for his father's paper. He used to help us solve some portentous questions of moral or political ethics in our juvenile debating club, Turner wrote. Quote, and subsequently, after catching a spark of Methodism in the camp meeting away down in the woods on the Vienna Road, he was a very passable exhorter in the evening meetings. History of the Pioneer Settlement of Phelps and Gorham's Purchase, page 214. History has given us an American prophet who needs to be explained in terms of divine revelation, cultural synthesis, or something in between. It really does not matter whether or not one proves that Joseph Smith actually read any specific manuscript or book. The very existence of the parallels themselves, their great number, distribution, and uncanny resemblance to the doctrinal, theological, and sociological structures Joseph formed demand our attention. We often forget that it was Joseph himself who exhorted us to, quote, gather all the good and true principles in the world and treasure them up, or we shall not come out true Mormons, History of the Church, Volume 5, page 517. Shall we deny that Joseph practiced what he preached? He seems to have acknowledged that truth is not found in a vacuum. Instead of flatly denying the possible significance of so many striking parallels to Mormon thinking, or engaging in petty disputes over fine points of comparison, why not attempt rather to view many of the parallel sources both as cultural indicators and as catalysts for Joseph's fertile and questioning mind? Is a doctrine false simply because it appears to arise from the mundane? Of course not. Let us stop denying the parallels and start understanding their relevance to Mormon historiography. From proverbial attics, dusty old bookshops, book fairs and catalogs, through auction, telephone calls, and pleasant drives to small New England towns, a seemingly endless variety of Mormon parallels has begun to appear. If these books and papers were conscious beings, they might huddle about nervously on their shelves, ruffling their leaves, wondering when the Mormons were coming to read what they had to say. Here now is a sampling from the fascinating material which has awaited our attention for two centuries. Most serious students of the First Vision have come to realize that Joseph Smith was not the only reawakened youth who received a dramatic answer to fervent prayer in the early 1800s. Individual retreats to forest, grove, and field in secret prayer following revivals for forgiveness of sin were the norm, not the exception. A number of young men and women claimed visions, and nearly all described the effects their experiences had on their souls. Humble, Mehetable Forbush hoped that she had been, quote, enabled by an eye of faith to behold the Lamb of God that taketh away the sins of the world, end quote. Benjamin Putnam, at age 13, quote, instantly had a view, he thought, quote, of the Lord Jesus Christ with his arms extended in an inviting posture. And Elias Smith, 1 year older, saw the lamb once slain in the woods a dozen miles from Sharon, Vermont. The view of the lamb on Mount Sion left him rejoicing, quote, that at that time my mind was enlightened to behold the glory of God in the face of Jesus. Whittier's neighbor believed he had seen the sign of the Son of Man in the heavens at noonday, a glorious human form. While Elijah Bishop's Savior led him, quote, up the mountain, where I heard sounds and saw things which is not lawful for man to utter. The Bishop and Forbush accounts appear in unpublished manuscripts I discovered, each in the hand of the principal involved. Putnam's vision will be found on pages 15 to 19 of his sketch of 1821, printed in Woodstock, Vermont, the site of Elias Smith's 1785 experience, shared on pages 58 to 61 of Smith's 1816 life story, published in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. The Whittier reminiscence is preserved in his rare and splendid Supernaturalism of New England, published in 1847 in New York and London. As Mark Thomas has pointed out in Sunstone magazine, many of these awakening experiences strongly resembled the content of Book of Mormon revival sequences. I have also located revival narratives which parallel imagery found in Jacob, Mosiah, Alma, Helaman, 3 Nephi, and Ether. Jacob Young retired to the solitary grove and sought the Lord, wandering from tree to tree, moaning like a dove. Returning to the house, he passed out on the floor. Quote, the light appeared to shine from the south part of heaven, and God, in mercy, lifted up the light of his countenance upon me, and I rejoiced with joy unspeakable and full of glory. Samuel Frothingham told how, quote, several were powerfully wrought upon, end quote, in an early 19th century revival. Quote, sinners began to be pricked to their hearts and cry out under a sense of their sin and guilt. Then they, quote, like Paul, fell prostrate and lay as if dead, being so completely overcome with the power of God that they were unable to rise. See Young's 1857 autobiography, pages 42 to 3, and Frothingham's short account, Boston, 1811, of which three copies are known to exist, pages 5 to 6. One finds more examples of the prayer conversion phenomena in the published lives of Peter Cartwright, Jotham Sewell, Harlan Page, John Colby, Abel Thornton, Hannah Hobby, Ariel Kendrick, and many others. In reality, Joseph Smith's account of his vision, related in 1831-2, provides no really unparalleled content, but resembles many of the Christ-forgiveness visions of his day. Even the more developed features of his final account were not unique to the early 19th century religious scene. In 1805, the year Joseph Smith was born, Frederick Plummer viewed Christ on the cross in full gory detail, and afterward argued that the Father and the Son are two separate, distinct beings. Like Joseph, he became, quote, convinced that the Lord had committed unto me a dispensation of the gospel. But there has been great opposition from the different sects, and their priests pronounce me an heretic, because I reject all creeds and doctrines of men. This is found in Plummer's Mystery Revealed, Exeter, New Hampshire, 1813, pages 11 to 12. No one knows for sure why Joseph Smith spoke so little of his first vision during the earliest days of the church, but perhaps, as these parallels suggest, he did not consider it original enough to single out in his proselyting or doctrinal expositions. Closely associated with the concept of visions, Robert Pollock's allegory of the Tree of Life in his 1827 Course of Time clearly displays a kind of imagery later found in the Book of Mormon. As in Lehi's dream, Pollock's Tree of Life bore, quote, the only fruit of true delight, the only fruit worth plucking under heaven, end quote. Few could see the holy plant, quote, for heavy mists that sin around it threw, end quote. To find the tree, one had to tread and bruise the world beneath the foot, shutting the ear to its riches and fine clothing, its flatteries and praise. Most people derided the tree and set out on 10,000 different routes, pages 90 to 93. A more dramatic vision parallel leading us to the Book of Mormon appears in the powerful story told by Sarah Josepha Hale of a young man who stopped in the woods to pray. He felt powerless to discover the history of his people, how they came to America and then perished, quote, and where the archives of their history, their tomes or volumes of kings forgotten lie. Slowly a vision came. In the midst of flashing light, the genius of oblivion, a ghost of civilizations past, appeared. Solemnly, the spirit explained that the first American inhabitants had come from Tyre, not far from Jerusalem, during the siege of Nebuchadnezzar. A small band of people fled by ship across the Atlantic to the New World, a blessed, quote, Western Eden. Mrs. Hale's epic poem, With Uneasy Shades of Camorra, was published in 1823, the year of view of the Hebrews, and of Moroni's first visit to Joseph Smith. It was entitled The Genius of Oblivion, printed half a dozen miles from Ethan Smith's former Congregational Church in New Hampshire. And the name of the visionary young man, favored with the knowledge of the first American inhabitants, not Mormon, but Ormond. More detailed parallels are hardly lacking to the long lists of Hebrew Indian origin works, such as those published most recently in Dan Vogel's fine book, Indian Origins and the Book of Mormon. I have added sources which reflect supposedly original Book of Mormon contents. Some of these books speak of lost Indian records, reflect early Nephite theology, and list the names of Nephi, Lehi, Laban, Lemuel, and Ether, all before 1830. Although view of the Hebrews has been singled out regularly by most authors, how many writers know about Ethan Smith's other books, including his interesting Key to the Figurative Language found in the Sacred Scriptures? This little paper-bound work, published in 1814, includes the notion that many ancient nations used Egyptian hieroglyphics to write their own, more symbolic material. Does this sound familiar? That same Reformed Egyptian-like theme was also taken up the very year the Book of Mormon was printed. The American biblical scholar Moses Stuart concluded by 1830 that inasmuch as, quote, Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, who can well suppose that some of his written characters in Hebrew would not be more or less conformed to the Egyptian mode of writing them. Stuart compared the hieroglyphs of Mexico with those of Egypt and concluded with the expectation that, quote, much more relation will be shown to have existed between the old Egyptian and the Hebrew than has hitherto been supposed. Stuart's commentary appears in J.G.H. Greppo's Essay on the Hieroglyphic System of Mr. Champollion, Jr., First American Edition, 1830. In conjunction with the tenuous and sometimes forced parallels which Mormon apologists repeatedly extract from the ancient world, it is only a matter of time until a systematic catalog of supposedly unique Book of Mormon or related parallels will be possible, which draws from the surprisingly more similar, infinitely more numerous 19th century examples which cry out from Joseph Smith's own backyard. Such a catalog would contain many works established in my recent preliminary bibliography of Mormon parallels, such as the words of Handsome Lake. Nearly anticipating our three Nephites, that Seneca Indian prophet, who died in 1815, spoke of, quote, wondrous visions, unquote, of three imposing men, all alike, who told him how things ought to be on the earth. And how many students have read carefully Josiah Priest's 1833 American Antiquities? Joseph Smith evidently did, for as editor of the Times and Seasons, he quoted from it twice in 1842. This widely read book contained a great deal of speculation about ancient America, which should sound rather familiar to Mormon ears. On page 129, Priest quotes the opinion of Samuel L. Mitchell, yes, the same to whom Martin Harris took the Anthon transcript in 1828, who believed, quote, that America was the country where Adam was created, end of quote. Priest himself felt that the ancestors of the Indians came across the Pacific Ocean, knew of brass and steel, brickmaking, and the domestication of many animals. He reported the discovery of an ancient American steel bow, which, as in 1 Nephi 16:18, quote, was corroded or broken, end quote, pages 176 to 7. For Handsome Lake, see The Magic World, American Indian Songs and Poems, New York, 1971. Our catalog of modern Book of Mormon parallels would also be as incomplete as current related Book of Mormon studies if it did not list Mary Jemison's 1823 description I have identified of the Seneca Indian legend of the ancient hill fort not far from Cumorah, associated with an ancient advanced race which was totally destroyed. This was published and readily available in nearby Palmyra in 1824. It reminds us once again of Lehi's dream of the iron rod, with Jemison's further recollection of a local Indian religious metaphor of the half-inch wide line we must follow to paradise, turning neither, quote, to the right hand or the left into paths of vice. Descriptions which Jemison and others preserved of Indian executions, similar to that of the Book of Mormon's Abinadi, are more graphic than necessary for inclusion here. Refer to James E. Seaver's Narrative of the Life of Mrs. Mary Jemison, many editions, beginning with Canandaigua, New York, 1824. As a Book of Mormon parallel, the subject of anti-Masonry suffers from overly simplistic dismissals by a number of Mormon writers who show little evidence of having plumbed the depths of the literature involved or the implications of the evidence concerned. Although the Book of Mormon has its anti-Nephi-Lehis, there are no characters in it called anti-Mason-Masons. That seemingly is what it would take to convince some Mormon writers that certain passages in the Book of Mormon reflect anti-Masonic sentiment. In early 1831, the Painesville, Ohio, Geauga Gazette quoted Martin Harris as publicly declaring, quote, that the Golden Bible is the anti-Masonic Bible, and that all who do not believe in it will be damned. March 15, 1831, Volume 3, Issue 25. Martin's declaration was no cavalier denial of the divine nature of the Book of Mormon, but a simple, politically astute observation that he thought the book contained much which would be acceptable to his anti-Masonic audience. It certainly warned against secret combinations that threatened both church and state. Stories of evil men taking oaths to subvert justice sounded only too familiar, as did their signs, passwords, and even aprons made of lambskin. Despite all the arguments against the anti-Masonic parallels, which apologists may profess, it was Nephi himself who connected the two phenomena as one. About 550 BC, Nephi prophesied that in the last days, at a time when the Gentiles would have smitten the Lamanites and built up many churches, and when the Book of Mormon would come forth, there would be, quote, secret combinations, even as in times of old, according to the combinations of the devil, for he is the founder of murder and works of darkness, yea, and he leadeth them by the neck with a flaxen cord, until he bindeth them with his strong cords forever. 2 Nephi 26:22. Most of Nephi's latter-day Gentiles, the European Americans, learned of the cord to which Nephi alluded from or as a result of William Morgan's 1826 illustrations of Masonry. It was called a cable toe. Used in Masonic initiations, it became a symbol of unjust domination by the fraternity in the anti-Masonic literature. Of course, such 19th century anti-Masonic writing also contained much that would be extraneous to the Book of Mormon. No interpretation of the Book of Mormon, whether as literal translation of ancient words or the opposite extreme of deliberate modern fabrication, could conceivably admit of a total borrowing of every tangential element of anti-Masonry into its text. Richard Bushman, Blake Osler, and other writers have seized upon this obvious fact with more delight than I feel it justifies. They further suggest, as in Bushman's Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism, page 131, that the Book of Mormon secret robber societies could be viewed by a different, say, 20th century audience as terrorist dissenters, quote, undermining from within and attacking openly when they had strength, end of quote, rather than as 19th century secret Masonic combinations. Perhaps this is quite true, but, in fact, irrelevant. In the 21st century, talks may be given in the Mormon tabernacle admonishing the saints to beware of insidious yuppie capitalist power brokers, of which Nephi of old will have warned us when he prophesied of evil secret combinations marshaling their forces in the latter days. What matters here, in my opinion, is what the Book of Mormon itself contributes to our perception of 19th century anti-Masonic parallels in its text, and how contemporaries of Joseph Smith understood it. The central elements of anti-Masonry and of these Book of Mormon warnings were identical. In Joseph Smith's society, what really disturbed the average person on the street or on the farm were the very aspects of the anti-Masonic craze which he or she accepted so naturally in the Book of Mormon. The uneasy suspicion that an old combination was growing in their midst unseen, founded on secrecy and collusion, bent on attaining power and gain through the organized destruction of Christian society and religion. Some people have argued, quite understandably, that since Joseph Smith eventually became a master mason and appears to have incorporated much Masonic symbolism and language into the temple tradition, how could he have been an anti-Mason? How could he be in both camps? Recently, I have discovered several anti-Masonic publications by former Masons who still believed in the essential form and precepts of some supposedly ancient, uncorrupted Freemasonry to which they still held. These anti-Mason Masons, as I would call them, claimed that it was not ancient Freemasonry which disturbed them, but its excesses and misuse by wicked adherents in modern times. Joseph Smith may well have felt the same way. Parallels between 19th century Masonic initiation ceremonies and the Mormon temple endowment have been perceived for over a century by apologists and anti-Mormons alike. Much literature from the 19th century substantiates the validity of these impressions. The Masonic Five Points of Fellowship are a prime and prevalent example from the 1820s, with their accompanying whispered phrase, "There is marrow in the bone." At the 1974 Mormon History Association meetings in Nauvoo, Illinois, Dr. Reed C. Durham, LDS Institute Director at the University of Utah, presented the now-famous talk, "Is There No Help for the Widow's Son?" His enumeration of early 19th century Masonic parallels in Mormonism was based on Webb's Masonic Monitor books and various other works discussing an inscribed plate of gold hidden underground behind a stone door, spheres which solve problems something like the Liahona, and other pointed similarities to the Book of Mormon and its origins. The talk created quite a stir, but it was never authorized to be printed. Even now, only rare unofficial printings circulate. Although several authors have attempted to address the issue of Masonic tradition and symbolism and its apparent connection to Mormonism, no truly comprehensive scholarly synthesis commentary has yet been published. This has also been the case with regard to the now widely recognized claim that Joseph Smith and his family were once involved in various magic or occult practices. The appearance of Dr. Michael Quinn's new book, Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, may make a rehearsal of numerous fascinating sources I have discovered in the area of gold digging and the occult superfluous. I will just mention that among examples I have owned are a seer stone of the Whitmer family, believed by Alvin R. Dyer to be that of Hiram Page, which occasioned the revelation of Doctrine and Covenants 28, and two examples of the Magus by Francis Barrett, London, 1801. Besides its illustration for making the Jupiter talisman worn by Joseph Smith, that truly eerie book also shows how to make and use something like a Urim and Thummim, a crystal set in a small gold plate to receive visions. Having a notebook ready in which to transcribe what may be seen, including a spirit who must be tested for true identity, the inquirer prays, quote, that his spiritual eye may be opened, end quote, assuring the Lord that he, quote, desires neither evil treasures nor injury to his neighbor. The reader will notice in the Magus certain magic symbols which are nearly identical to characters later seen in Joseph Smith's Anthon transcript from the plates of the Book of Mormon. I was also intrigued by an original 1821 letter from Reverend Joseph Avery explaining the theory and use of divining rods. I must add, he wrote, that the rod is influenced in comparatively few hands. It is particularly in the area of general Mormon doctrine that the greatest number of parallel surprises still await our discovery and attention. Mormon historians have done very little in this area, and much which they have touched upon has been oversimplified or misunderstood. Consider Richard Brothers, who claimed that the blood of Israel flows in English veins. In the late 1700s, he had revelations to inform individuals that they descended from the ancient Hebrews, as in the opening lines of Mormon patriarchal blessings today. This same feat was performed with divining rods near the Cowdery House in Middletown, Vermont, in 1801, as we learn from the first-hand observation of Reverend Laban Clark, founder of Wesleyan College, quoted by Barnes Frisby in The History of Middletown, 1867, page 55. Consider Samuel Sherwood's The Church's Flight into the Wilderness, New York, 1776, which shows America, quote, reserved in Providence as a fixed and settled habitation for God's church. This book was dedicated by the author to members of the Continental Congress and others who, as in 2 Nephi 10 and Doctrine and Covenants 101, were, in Sherwood's words, quote, raised up, unquote, by God, quote, to be his glorious instruments to fulfill scripture prophecies in favor of his church and American liberty. The theme of America set aside as a special place for the reestablishment of God's church and people is familiar indeed when one turns to the religious literature of our new nation. For some reason, a dramatic parallel to Nephi's vision of Columbus and the Gentiles in the New World has been missed by Mormon message and its context. In The Conquest of Canaan, Timothy DeWhite describes a vision given to an ancient Israelite showing the latter days. Think of the message of Nephi's vision as we listen to DeWhite's 1785 version, beginning with a blessing on the crew of the Niña, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. Speed, speed, ye sons of truth, let heaven befriend, let angels waft you, and let peace attend. O smile, thou skies serene, ye storms, retire, and airs of Eden every sail inspire. Swift o'er the main, behold the canvas fly, and fade beneath the farthest sky. See verdant fields the changing waste unfold, see sudden harvests dress the plains in gold. In lofty walls the moving rocks ascend, and dancing woods to spires and temples bend. Another surprising doctrinal parallel example appears in Hosea Ballou's famous and widely circulated Universalist Treatise on Atonement, first published the year Joseph Smith was born, about 15 miles from his birthplace. Of, quote, eternal punishment, end quote, almost identical to Joseph's supposedly unique commentary on the same subject known to Mormons in Doctrine and Covenants 19. I say, Ballou wrote, the word eternal is not applied to the duration, but to the nature of that life which is brought to light through the gospel, of the nature of unchangeable deity. Mary Hoebner's treatise on the state of souls separated from their bodies, published by the New York State Universalist Nathaniel Stacy in 1817, states that in the life to come, from the most wicked to the most holy, there are infinite degrees, and insists that Christ preached to the spirits in prison to bring them to repentance and the knowledge of truth, pages 71-103. Professor Wilford Polson of Brigham Young University wrote about the popular Journal of Health, which began in 1831 and contained virtually all the health concepts which were later expressed in Doctrine and Covenants 89-1833. I have discovered that Joseph Smith recorded that word of wisdom the very day following the great nationwide temperance observance projected in the American Temperance Almanac for 1833. In the fall 1978 BYU studies, Michael Quinn told a fascinating tale of Mormon prayer circles, including partial examples at American Revival meetings. I recently uncovered such a practice in a manuscript camp meeting description from early 19th century New York. I quote from the anonymous author, "They arose in the morning full of spirit and life, forming circles for singing and prayer. After preaching, circles were formed. The exercises in the circles continued through the greater part of the night, some crying for mercy, others praying for the distressed." In Retrospective Theology or the Opinions of the World of Spirits, Philadelphia, 1825, Ezra Stiles Ely recounted a dream in which he visited the future afterlife and discovered certain principles clearly paralleling those of later Mormonism. Included were ideas concerning, quote, different degrees of honor and felicity, unquote, among the saved in heaven. The idea that the glorified inhabitants may visit the condemned in lower spheres without the reverse being possible. The Alma-like belief that immortals, quote, possess every mental faculty which they had in their previous state of existence, end quote. A conviction that infants who die before an age of accountability are automatically glorified in heaven. And the clarification that foreordination and foreknowledge, not predestination, are the rule. Mormon's plurality of worlds concept appears for the first time in Joseph Smith's 1830 Visions of Moses in the Pearl of Great Price. Dr. Robert Paul, in his summer 1986 dialogue article, Joseph Smith and the Plurality of Worlds Idea, concedes that Joseph Smith may have borrowed some of his basic ideas from contemporary thought, but insists upon 9 additional views which were supposedly totally original with Joseph. In fact, however, the essence of all of these concepts appears regularly in the literature of Joseph Smith's day, if one knows where to look. Even the most elementary children's textbooks contain much that would surprise most Mormons today. An adequate treatment of Mormon cosmology is still wanting. Our writers seem to be unaware of many early sources which show the astronomy of the Restoration to be much less original than they think. The following extracts include clear parallels to esoteric Mormon ideas, too often attributed uniquely to the revelations of Joseph Smith and to later science. From Thomas Chalmers' Discourses on the Christian Revelation, viewed in Connecting 19 edition, we learn on page 30 that, quote, in the same manner as the planets with their satellites revolve round the sun, may the sun with all his tributaries be moving in common with other stars around some distant center from which there emanates an influence to bind and to subordinate them all. On page 105, we read as in Abraham 3:4, that to God, quote, one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. And from pages 55 and 84, quote, the eternal Son, by whom the worlds were created, may have had the government of many sinful worlds laid upon his shoulders, and, quote, the plan of redemption may have its influences and its bearings on those creatures of God who people other regions. 2 generations ago, Fawn Brody tried to tell us of the surprising Mormon parallels in the writings of Thomas Dick. In his generally flippant response, "No, ma'am, that's not history," 1946, page 16, Hugh Nibley artfully ignored most of Dick's parallels and apparently could not be bothered to check the bibliographic sources, which would have shown him that Dick's ideas were published in America before Joseph Smith recorded any of his astronomy concepts. Only last year, a Mormon writer used Dick's personal theology to distract us from a major parallel that seems only to lack the name Kolob to spring from the same font as Joseph Smith's Book of Abraham. Has anyone in the church read Dick's philosophy of a future state? Oliver Cowdery did, and Joseph Smith gave a copy of, quote, Dick's philosophy, unquote, to the Nauvoo Library. In 1827, Thomas Dick wrote that there may be, quote, an example of material creation exceeding all the rest in magnitude and splendor in the center of the universe, quote, termed the throne of God. This grand central body may be considered as the capital of the universe. Here the glorified body of the Redeemer may have taken its principal station, and here likewise Enoch and Elijah. This may be, quote, the third heavens, the throne of the eternal, the high and holy place. This is taken from pages 245 to 7 of an undated Philadelphia edition of 304 pages currently in my possession, a copy which was once part of an early upstate New York library. Dick continues on page 249, quote, "The whole assemblage of suns and worlds revolves around the grand center of the universe, this center where the throne of God is placed, superior to all other provinces of creation. As we read in Abraham 3, 2-3, and I saw the stars, that they were very great, and that one of them was nearest unto the throne of God. And the Lord said unto me, These are the governing ones, and the name of the great one is Kolob, because it is near unto me." We learn in Doctrine and Covenants 129, 1 and 3, 1843, that, quote, "There are two kinds of beings in heaven, namely, angels having bodies of flesh and bones, secondly, the spirits of just men made perfect," end quote, "and that either can appear as messengers from God." Thomas Dick had already explained this years earlier when he wrote that angels are probably, quote, "invested with bodies or fine material vehicles," pages 163 to 4, and that similarly, quote, "it is not improbable that the spirits of just men made perfect are likewise occasionally employed in similar services," pages 279 to 80. On, quote, "degrees of glory," unquote, Dick stated that, quote, "the reward bestowed on those servants to whom talents were entrusted was in proportion to the improvement they had made. For as one star differeth from another in glory, so also is the resurrection from the dead," pages 193 to 4. Dick wrote of intelligences and preceded Joseph Smith in saying that, quote, "the work of creation is still going forward in the distant regions of the universe, and the Creator is replenishing the voids of space with new worlds and new orders of intelligent beings. New systems will be continually emerging into existence while eternal ages are rolling on," page 97. Many more examples in the writings of these and other popular 18th and 19th century authors, and virtually every general appear in these works, and virtually every general concept of early Mormon cosmology is embodied therein. Most Latter-day Saints have heard of the Shakers, or United Believers in Christ. On the surface, at least, anyone can readily perceive in their writings such esoteric and supposedly Mormon language as that of consecration, spiritual creation, Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother, parents of spiritual children, pre-existence of matter, souls as organized intelligence, worlds within worlds, the primitive church based on revelation, Jesus married to an actual bride, salvation for the dead, and many more examples. In 1980, Eugene Siech overconfidently exclaimed that the world is suddenly obliged to explain just how Joseph Smith was able to even name such beliefs as many of these, quote, "which no Christian sect of the time had ever heard of, let alone discussed or accepted." This from his Mormonism, the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the Nag Hammadi Texts, page 1. Siech was obviously not aware that not only the naming, but the publishing and accepting of such language and ideas took place continually less than 20 miles from the Kirtland Temple. Joseph Smith's contact with the nearby Shaker community cannot be trivialized. One of the first missionary efforts by the Kirtland Church in 1831 was directed toward the Shaker colony from which Lyman Copley had been converted to Mormonism. In fact, Section 49 of the Doctrine and Covenants came as a direct result of various questions Joseph raised concerning Shaker belief. A very close associate of the prophet, Hosea Stout, spent 4 years of his childhood with the Shakers at Pleasant Hill, Kentucky, where his sister became a deaconess, as we read in Stout's autobiography, 1810 to 44, 1962, pages 10 to 18. And as Phineas Young reported to his brother Brigham on 31st of December, 1844, in the Journal History, page 3, Martin Harris eventually believed in Shakerism with a testimony, quote, greater than it was of the Book of Mormon. What did the Shakers teach that could so have attracted one of the three witnesses to the Book of Mormon? The examples are so numerous as to defy adequate coverage here. A few examples certainly will be more than suggestive. Benjamin Seth Youngs wrote a momentous Shaker work entitled The Testimony of Christ's Second Appearing, containing a general statement of all things pertaining to the faith and practice of the Church of God in this latter day. In the third edition, published in Ohio in 1823, we read on page 3, quote, it is certain that the matter of which the body of man is composed existed before the human body was formed, and that matter was incapable of comprehending its intermediate state before it was organized into human form. As the Mormons would learn years later, after Joseph Smith had reacted to the nearby Shakers in northern Ohio, quote, the elements are eternal, and the spirit and element inseparably connected receive a fullness of joy. Doctrine and Covenants 93:33, 1833. Any active Mormon knows the Church's response to Catholic claims that Peter was the rock upon which Christ built his church. As we read in the History of the Church, Volume 5, page 258, Jesus in his teaching says, upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. What rock? Revelation. This is what Benjamin Seth Youngs had written many years earlier when he said that, quote, the revelation of God through Christ was therefore the rock upon which he promised to build his church, page 93. And how was his church built? Mormons would certainly be interested in the explanation found in Young's book, pages 399 to 400, that, quote, there was a true church in the days of the apostles, which was supplanted and trodden underfoot, yet the order in the foundation of the building was not completed according to the purpose of God in the fullness of times, nor could it be until Christ made his second appearing. On page 438, we find another familiar-sounding phrase as Youngs refers to, quote, the one joint testimony of father and mother by which their spiritual children are begotten, conceived, and brought forth in the new creation. In 1823, another major Shaker doctrinal exposition appeared under the editorship of Calvin Green and Seth Y. Wells, entitled A Summary View of the Millennial Church. This remarkable book, printed in New York State, explained that, as Mormons would also later word it, it is a privilege, quote, to devote and consecrate himself, soul and body, time and talents, with all his earthly inheritance, to the service of God forever, page 54, explaining that, quote, members do freely, of their own deliberate choice, dedicate, devote, and consecrate themselves with all they possess to the service of God forever, page 57. On Salvation for the Dead, the summary view speaks of the millions who never heard the gospel in this world, following the example of Christ after his crucifixion, quote, his faithful and true witnesses, after putting off this mortal body, will find a work to do in preaching the gospel to those benighted spirits who never heard its peaceful sound in this world, page 172. Green and Wells also assert that, quote, it would be very inconsistent to call the Lord Jesus a bridegroom without admitting him to have a bride, end quote, emphasizing that the bride is not the church, page 223. The following passage, at the end of this startling Shaker book, requires but an opening prayer to convince us that we are sitting in a Latter-day Saint Sunday school class. Quote, be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect. Would Christ require anything impossible or unreasonable as people? Certainly not. God declared Job to be a perfect and upright man. Noah was also declared to be a just man and perfect in his generations. The Apostle Paul saith, we speak wisdom to them that are perfect. Anything may with strict propriety be called perfect, which perfectly answers the purpose for which it was designed. A circle may be called a perfect circle. The idea which most people have of perfection is a state in which there can be no increase for the better. This is a mistaken idea. Such a state never will be attained, neither in time nor eternity. End quote. Sounding just like Brigham Young in the Journal of Discourses, Volume 1, page 350, this Shaker text goes on to explain that perfection lies in eternal, quote, progressive growth in the knowledge and nature of God to the endless ages of eternity, page 320, the only alternative to which would be decay. Finally, In 1853, Frederick W. Evans, a major Shaker writer, attempted to clarify his people's doctrines for a critical world. In a short treatise on the second appearing of Christ in and through the order of the female, Evans referred to, quote, the true order of the Godhead, an eternal heavenly Father and an eternal heavenly Mother, page 15. On page 5, Evans sounds much like Brigham Young as he declares, there is a spirit world which stands in as close relation to this world as does the soul of man to his body, and into that world all souls enter at death. Evans sounds like Alma as he continues, every soul is an organized substance or being, and in all respects and particulars retains in the spirit world not only its identity but also its character, just as it would had it remained in the body, page 5. Evans explained on page 19 that, quote, in the spiritual order, the male and female are regenerated and redeemed from the earth, and thus they become resurrected and spiritualized. Their procreative powers and faculties are no more destroyed than are their other senses and faculties, but their whole being is elevated from the earthly into the heavenly sphere, in which they, by the joint word of their testimony, can beget and bring forth souls of the natural order as spiritual offspring in the image of the second Adam and Eve, who procreate a spiritual offspring, so are they who are heavenly, their spiritual posterity, and who also procreate souls to God in the spiritual order. Although many Shaker concepts, such as the preexistence of matter and salvation for the dead, are clearly parallel to Mormon doctrine, scholars who are acquainted with Shaker theology know that terms which appear in their literature, such as Heavenly Mother and spiritual creation, for example, do not mean the same things as they do in Mormonism. The same is true, incidentally, for many ancient, supposedly Mormon parallels, although their proponents may not be so candid. The point to be made with the 19th century Shaker parallels, however, is that the language of various curious doctrines, so often assumed to be unique to Mormonism, was clearly available to Joseph Smith, and the Shakers themselves complained that their terminology was generally taken at face value by other religious groups of the time. This essay has provided a sampling, not a summary, of many of the interesting Mormon parallels I've located in recent years. My descriptions are, perforce, weighted toward a selection from each book of those portions which seem similar to Mormonism. Never, however, have I consciously quoted these passages in any manner calculated to misconstrue the sense the authors intended. These latter-day parallels fill the vacuum in which so many Mormons believe their religion was restored. It is our duty, I believe, to assemble as many of history's tangible remnants as possible in order to learn its patterns and design. When the tapestry of the larger culture is unrolled and held to various lights, the intersecting threads must not only be traced from end to end, but examined at the points where they cross to determine the sources and recipients of the colors thus shared and transposed. In so doing, the faith itself may emerge unscathed, but the artificial bolsters of supposed originality or brilliant inspiration must in many instances be left by the wayside. Joseph Smith may remain a prophet, but one should not try to use the prophecy on war to prove it. No talk of humbuggery or Masonic parallels or views of Hebrews once in vogue will dishonor the faith of a 14-year-old youth praying alone in the woods. No leading string of quotations need join to insinuate what need not even be supposed. But on every hand, at nearly every point of inquiry, new sources are appearing which proclaim the world and culture of Joseph Smith. As time goes on, it will sound increasingly naive for us to exclaim, whoever wrote such things before? Thank you.
Rick has obviously gone to a great deal of work and has prepared an interesting and informative paper. I've been following his developing interest for some time and have searched with increasing interest the bibliography of Mormon parallels that he has prepared, which is available, and I suspect he would sell you if you asked. I'm convinced that his contribution to Mormon historiography is important, and it is significant, if not altogether a happy contribution. As you're all aware, a significant book dealer does more than deal by buying and selling books. As is the case here, Rick has been the provocateur, thus in many respects the scholar, for Mormon Parallels. And it is in keeping with this tradition that this paper was presented and I hope is accepted. I think most would agree he has but scratched the surface of a vast area of interest. Michael Quinn, in his interesting and significant new book just put out by Signature Press, has shown us just how foolish it is to ignore the times and the seasons of the birth of our movement. There can be little doubt that Joseph Smith Jr. was influenced, as all persons are influenced, by the times in which he lived and worked. But that influence cannot always be seen as environmental or cultural. It was not just that he lived among a peculiar kind of people in a particular time or place, but that he was influenced by the reading of and the absorption of works and ideas dealing with a topic about which he had initial interest and later about which he himself would create vast documents. I think Rick is wrong when he says on page 2 it doesn't really matter whether or not one proves that Joseph Smith actually read any specific manuscript or book. I think it matters very much. I suspect Rick thinks it matters very much, but he is led, I believe, to occasionally dropping this disclaimer, hopes of not overly offending his potential buying public. It matters if Joseph took ideas from other published works. It matters if he used the words of others to state his belief. It matters if Joseph's vision stories are simply eclectics of existing and already published accounts. It matters a great deal if the story of the Book of Mormon was a long story told and published by others. It may not be crucial to your individual faith, but believe me, it matters, and it will make a difference. Anyone who has written more than a personal letter knows that the amount of influence others have upon the things you write. It is impossible to ignore what you have read, to avoid taking an occasional phrase or turn of words, or to remember something as your own that might more honestly be remembered as somebody else's. In the name of scholarship, we give but brief acknowledgement to patterns or outlines that we borrow to use as the framework of our own investigations. But it is certainly questionable, and it certainly makes a considerable difference about what we say when we copy sections or take main ideas or rephrase storylines. We know this, and any scholar seeking the source of Joseph Smith's presentations in the Book of Mormon or anywhere else will have difficulties because of the created similarities that we have seen. I think a great deal of what brings persons to the feet of the Mormon giant is its mystery. I am aware that for many of our people, both LDS and RLDS, the Church provides answers, and in those answers comes a kind of peace and security. But it is not without understanding of the mystical nature of the source of these answers available. And the early vision experience, the Book of Mormon, the early revelations of Joseph, these things are seen as unique. Unique in the sense they happen to Joseph as a part of the exploration of a heavenly concern, and unique in the sense they represent answers to these concerns. When these events become common, as in the unlimited number of vision experiences by young persons reporting within 100 miles of his home, then the source of the answer becomes a part of the question. When we discover, as we do at looking at some of these perils, that the ideas and the stories and the experiences and even the names and the places exist openly and without explanation in the writings of an age and a place, we may not have disproven anything, but we have driven another nail into the coffin of the mysteries of Mormonism. Rick is wrong again, he says, on page 19, no talk of humbuggery or Masonic parallels or views of Hebrews once in vogue will dishonor the faith of a 14-year-old youth praying alone in the woods. humbuggery and Masonic parallels and views of Hebrews in vogue and strings of quotes will in fact question the faith and the honesty of a 14-year-old seeking answers, or more probably will question the faith of a 21-year-old seeking explanations for his behavior. Rick is to be congratulated for having given the lid of Pandora's box another gigantic jerk. But having done so, he must certainly acknowledge the spreading cloud of and suspicion that moves across the Mormon community because of such ideas. Well, I think there has been some pussyfooting down the primrose path here. Rick has made his point well. And he leaves us with a question, of course, as to what degree parallels tell us anything more than the fact that ideas were held in common. In future meetings, the scholars, certainly historians and theologians, are going to have to deal with the psycho-historical questions of motive and of assimilation, and eventually even questions of fraud in the face or perhaps in the name of faith. This is a generation of Tammy Baker and Mark Hoffman, and a con man by any other name is still a con man. Certainly there is not enough evidence to do anything at this point but to look further. But like the magic of the salamander, it is no longer dependent upon the legitimacy of the letter which introduced the question. Once the scholars get hold of the possibility, their research will take them places they never knew they would have to go. I appreciate what Rick is doing. I hope we all take it with a sufficient grain of salt, but I hope we eat it. Because in here and among these things are answers, or at least refreshing questions concerning our origins. Thanks, Rick.
Our schedule is still intact. We do have time for some questions. Then at this point, I would propose we...
Well, Paul's response was more generous than I anticipated, so I have nothing to rebut whatsoever. However, if it's of any interest to anyone, I guess we all wonder about motives. Why does someone go after this stuff? And I was the kind of kid who would always read an encyclopedia to see what they said about the Mormons. I wanted to know what people were saying about us. And then later when I started finding similarities, I thought, gee, isn't this great? I had a professor in English who was known at Boise State for being rather anti-Mormon, and I thought, well, I can go in here and fight him, or I can try to make it all fit into a bigger picture. And that seemed to work very nicely. Where it's taking me, I prefer to share with people on a personal basis, but I think what's important to me and what I would like people to get out of this, I'm not concerned how extreme on either end of a spectrum you may be if you respond to this material, but I would be so pleased if a paper like this would help people to desist from careless claims that Joseph Smith did this which was unique and original. I'm not concerned about where it takes someone's faith as long as they're honest with their evidence, their use of the evidence. That's really my message, I suppose, in the long run is, please, please don't cheat. Please don't go to Sunday school class or gospel doctrine class and quote the prophecy on war and say, see, this proves Joseph was a prophet. Because in the long run, that hurts his cause because it's easy to shoot it down piece by piece, in my personal opinion. That's just an illustration.
This session is adjourned.